And we're in Revelation chapter 5, and we'll aim for verses 1 through 5. In our previous study of Revelation chapter 4, John got to see the beauty and grandeur of God the Father seated on his throne. John got to see the fullness of the Holy Spirit present there. And John got to see the seraphim and, of course, all of God's people present and accounted for, gathered around the throne. And he did his best to try to explain it to us. He even had the Spirit of God inspiring him to write. But what can we say? No human language could possibly adequately capture such transcendent heavenly scenes. And worse yet is our imaginations. The human language can't capture it, and our human imaginations just take a complete whiff at it because we just don't have the necessary frame of reference to understand such transcendent things. Our only frame of reference, sadly, is earthly things, and they just don't compare. So it's tough to really get a full appreciation of what John saw there in chapter 4. But I can say with a great deal of confidence today that I do believe it's going to be much easier today and next week as we look at Revelation chapter 5, much easier for us to grasp because the monumental significance of what is happening here in Revelation chapter 5 is near and dear to the heart of every believer. So for that reason alone, the subject matter, I believe, the chapter is going to speak loud and clear to your hearts. In chapter 4, we read of thunder and lightning flashes around the throne. We read of ominous voices echoing throughout heaven, and we just got this idea that something was stirring, something was getting ready to happen. You know, when the storm clouds rise and the thunder and lightning begins, you know what follows. A storm is coming. And that is the scene that we were left with there in Revelation chapter 4, the Lord conveying that message to us that when we reach this point in prophecy, when the church is raptured up into heaven as John was in chapter 4, and we take those moments to behold the beauty of God in those transcendent heavenly scenes, we're going to notice something is getting ready to happen. A storm is coming. And let me help you. That storm is not a what. That storm is a who. That storm is the person of Jesus Christ. And what's going to happen in Revelation chapter 6 is Jesus in his judgment is going to be that storm that hits the entire earth. And without Revelation chapter 5, that would not happen. Revelation chapter 5, I cannot stress the importance of this event that we are studying today and next week. I believe, and try to convince me otherwise if you want, but I believe this is the second most important event in the history of Earth's time as it pertains to Earth, next to the crucifixion alone. The second most important event in the history of the time period of the existence of this earth. You might argue, well, wouldn't it be the second coming, Arlen? But you don't understand. The significance of Revelation chapter 5 lends itself to the very possibility of the second coming. And without what we see taking place in Revelation 5, the second coming either doesn't happen or it's quite different and it's not good news for any of us. But praise the Lord. Revelation chapter 5 is predicted by the Lord. It will take place. So let's take a look here at Revelation chapter 5, verse 1. And let's see if we can get through five verses. I got plenty of time to do that. I got an hour and a half before we need to eat. I'll just keep teaching and preaching until someone comes up and tells me the food's ready. How's that? Verse 1. And I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. As established last week, the one seated on the throne is none other than God the Father. And what John didn't notice in chapter 4, no doubt because of sensory perception overload, everything that he was viewing in heaven, the throne, God himself, the seraphim, the church, the worship of heaven, the colors, the rainbow, sensory overload for John. But now as John has more time to view this heavenly scene, he notices that in the right hand of God the Father is a scroll. It's called a book in the King James Version. And that's unfortunate because they didn't have books at this time. At the time that John is receiving this writing, they had scrolls. Now, I connect that as important because, as you're going to see in this chapter, everything that's happening in this chapter is set up through the imagery of ancient Jewish customs. And there's a scroll here. You all know what a scroll looks like, right? Would you know how to operate a scroll if that's what we had to read up from the scriptures up here? Would you know even what to do? Well, a scroll is a little bit different than a book. It too consists of pages. Most people don't realize that. It consists of pages, but those pages made of papyrus are glued together. They're pasted together to be whatever length that you would need for the writing that you were doing. You know, if you were writing and you ran out of space, you'd glue the next page on and you'd write some more, and eventually you'd have this one big long page glued together, and you'd roll it up from both sides onto a wooden handle. You'd roll it up like this, and then as you read, instead of like we do flipping pages, you scroll through the scroll, just like you scroll with your computer mouse. You scroll to the left, or pardon me, to the right and read. Actually, it would be the other way. They read, in Hebrew, they read actually right to left. So you'd scroll and read and scroll and read. Now, that's a fine system, except for when you have to carry your Bible to church. And you got like these suitcases with all these scrolls in them, and you got to find out where the pastor's reading from and then get out that scroll. Oh, we're on Isaiah. Give me the Isaiah scroll, and you got to roll that out. But that's what they had back then. Now, I know we didn't come today to learn about scrolls in general. We've come to learn about this scroll that we read about in Revelation chapter 5. Because properly identifying this scroll tells us exactly what's taking place here in this chapter and why it's so important. And never fear, we do know exactly what this scroll is. The definition is in the details. And we just read them. This scroll has writing on the inside and on the back or the outside, and it is sealed up with seven seals. It can only be one thing. Here's what it is. It is a title deed to a piece of property that has been sold to a new owner but can still be redeemed, bought back, if the proper conditions and requirements are met. Now, how in the world do I know all of that from just those few details that we covered? Again, ancient Jewish customs. That's how I know. When a Jewish man bought a piece of property, he was given a title deed to that piece of property. It was a scroll. And on the inside of that scroll, they would write the details of that sale. It was like a deed, a bill of receipt, any stipulations or contractual things that needed to be included in that exchange that was included, written on the inside of that scroll. And then once you purchased that and the title deed was written on the inside of that scroll, you would roll the scroll up and you would seal it. And you can read more about that in Jeremiah chapter 32, verses 6 through 29, because that's what Jeremiah is dealing with in that chapter, a title deed that is on a scroll, rolled up and sealed. But here's where it gets extremely intriguing, at least to me. If as that property owner, you fell on hard times and decided that you needed to sell that piece of property in order to make ends meet. Does anyone else do that, rob from Peter to pay Paul, or is it just me? You have something nice, but you want something else, or you have something nice and you got to pay for that something else, so you sell the nice thing and you think, I'll just get it later. And then later on, you do, because you sell something else to get it back. But you know how it goes. You could do that with a piece of property. According to Jewish law, that was totally legit. You could sell that to a new owner. And once you did, that new owner took that title deed on that scroll, and he broke that seal open. And then he unrolled that scroll a little bit, because there was something very important that needed to happen in that process. You see, there was a little caveat in Jewish law concerning the sale of property and land exchanges. There was a caveat in there that protect the original owner of that piece of property. And what this was is it was an open-ended deal for 7 years. You had this seven-year time window where you, the original owner that was selling that piece of property, could at any time within that seven-year time window meet the requirements, meet the conditions, meet the stipulations, and then you could buy that piece of property back. You could redeem it. The details of that redemption had to be agreed upon by you and the individual that you were selling that piece of property to. And once you came to that agreement on what those stipulations would be for a future potential redemption, you would take that and the new owner would write that out on the outside of the scroll, on the backside of the scroll. And then that new owner would take that title deed to that piece of property. He would roll it up. He would seal it with seven seals. And on the backside of that scroll, you could see those conditions that would need to be met if that original owner wanted to buy that piece of property back. So if you were a property owner buying a piece of property off of an existing property owner, you wouldn't get too excited. You wouldn't get too attached to that piece of property until that 7 year period passed, because you knew at any point during that 7 year window, that previous owner might come into some funds, might get squared away and back on his feet and decide, I want that property back, and then put up that money and meet those conditions written on the outside of that seven sealed scroll and be able to take that possession back, that land purchase back. So once you did that, once you made the sale and the new owner took that title deed, it was his for those 7 years, unless and until you purchased that back, and the clock was ticking. 1 year down the road, 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road, up to 7 years down the road, you could redeem that piece of property if the conditions and requirements were met. Now, there was another interesting caveat to Jewish law here, and that was that if you, the owner originally, who sold that piece of property to another, could not meet the requirements or pay the full price to get that land back, if you wanted it, and you had a generous family member, that family member could step in and he could meet those requirements for redemption written on the outside of that scroll, and then either give that piece of property back to you or at very least keep that piece of property within the family. With that said, here's what we know about Revelation chapter 5. This scroll in Revelation chapter 5 is a title deed to a piece of property. It has been sold to a new owner. There is still the possibility that it can be redeemed back to the original owner or restored to the original family. And what we are reading about in Revelation chapter 5 is a heavenly legal proceeding over the fate of that piece of property. Now, what is the property in question? What is the property that is up for grabs? Well, I think someone already said it. And if I gave you enough time, I'm sure you'd come to it. But let me help you out just a little bit. Peek ahead to Revelation chapter 6. Pretend we're not. But peek ahead to Revelation chapter 6. Someone, I won't say who yet, Someone is going to start breaking open the seven seals on this scroll that we're talking about in Revelation chapter 5. And as those seals are broken off one at a time, calamity is going to strike that piece of property pertaining to the scroll. And what is that piece of property? It's the whole earth. So do you see where we're going? What we're studying in Revelation chapter 5 is the title deed to the earth itself. It could not be anything else. Now, maybe you're confused right now, and that's okay. But if you let me quickly walk you through what the Bible consistently bears out about this topic, I'm confident you'll understand by the time we're done. In Genesis chapter 1, oh boy, Lord help us, he's starting at the beginning. In Genesis chapter 1, God created the earth. The planet was his to do with as he wished. And what did he do with it? He gave it to mankind. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, then God said, this is a discussion among the triune Godhead. God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them, mankind, have dominion, rule, authority, rights, over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So all the creeps too. So you see what happened? God created the earth, but then, if you will, took the title deed to earth and handed it over to mankind and said, it's yours. The dominion over this planet is yours. God created it, but he signed it over. He handed it over to mankind. So picture in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2, Adam and Eve with the title deed to the earth, tucked away in their dresser drawers. They were the owners. God created it. God gave it to them. They had the title deed for the planet. And then comes Genesis 3. Genesis 3, where Adam and Eve, through their sin, forfeited that, the dominion of the earth, the rule, the control, the title deed, they handed it all over to Satan, whom they had obeyed in the garden instead of God. It was spiritual bankruptcy. It was spiritual default. It was spiritual foreclosure on the property. Through sin, Adam and Eve, mankind, handed it all over to another kingdom. So now picture Satan taking possession of that scroll, breaking the seal open, writing the conditions for redemption, and then sealing it up with seven seals and crossing his fingers. It's his after 7 years if no one redeems it. Now, I know this idea sits uneasy with us, but it sure does explain a lot, doesn't it? Satan currently holds the title deed officially and legally to the earth. It explains one of the three temptations of Jesus there in Matthew chapter 4, where Satan effectively offered Jesus this scroll. Let me read it to you. Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain, this is verse 8, and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give you, the West, the East, which includes the Middle East. You want the Holy Lands, Jesus? You can have them. The North, the South, it's all yours, Jesus, even the prized possession of the earth. Jerusalem. It's all yours, Jesus, if you'll just bow down and worship me. And Jesus said to him, "Away with you, Satan." That means get bent. Get lost, right? "Away with you, Satan. For it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Now, do you notice that when Satan made the offer to Jesus for all of the kingdoms of the earth, did you notice that Jesus didn't say, "Nuh-uh, it's not yours to offer. This isn't legit." Jesus didn't say that. Isn't that what you would say when someone offers you something that you know they don't own? If I'm trying to sell you a bridge or an island or a state in this country, you'd probably say, "Arlen, get bent. I know you don't own it." Jesus doesn't say that here. He simply moves on to the truth. Number one, he was too wise to strike a deal with the devil. You should be too. And number two, he was too holy to worship at the feet of another. But I contest that the deal was legitimate. The deal was legitimate. Now, you never really can trust the devil to be good for his word. But I'm telling you, the validity of what Satan was offering Jesus that day is real. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4, Paul called Satan the god, little g, the god of this world. In Ephesians chapter 2, verse 2, Paul said that the course of this world is to go after the prince of the power of the air. In 1 John chapter 5, verse 19, the apostle John said that apart from the godly, the whole world lies under the sway, the motion, the control of the wicked one. And if that hasn't convinced you, how about this? Jesus says in three different locations throughout the Gospel of John that Satan is, and I quote, the ruler of this world. So doesn't that explain a lot when we look around and see the atrocities that take place on the planet? And if you don't like the atrocities that take place in this world, cancer, COVID, theft, depression, suicide, rape, murder, then I would encourage you to join the level-headed group. That's us, right? Anchored Fellowship. Level-headed Christianity. We have our heads on straight because we aren't blaming God for stuff that he isn't doing. What we do at Anchored Fellowship is put the blame where it should be. We're blaming current management. We're blaming the holder of the scroll, the title deed to this earth. So what we're doing is biding our time. We're occupying until he comes, as he told us to. We're patiently waiting for much better property management. Well, at least most of us are. Some of us are impatiently waiting, but nonetheless, we're waiting for better property management, and that day is coming. Now, this is not to say that God is not the God of the earth, and that God is not sovereignly in control. He truly is. This is not to say that Satan has full power and full reign on the earth and can do what he wants. No. God is still ultimately in control. He always has been. He always will be. But what we see is that in general, the Lord usually honors this title deed and stays out of it and leaves mankind to mankind's own devices. He gives you a taste of current management. He gives you an offer of another kingdom that you could be a part of, which we'll talk about at the end of this message. He wants you to see the management styles of both, and he wants you to make a choice. But he, in general, will stay out of things until it is necessary for God to intervene, because we say it like this: there is a devil, but he's still God's devil, and the Lord has him on a leash. He only lets him do so much. There's still a time period where redemption could take place, right? So what the Lord is doing, and I understand it's not a perfect picture of the complexities of the fight over earth and all of its inhabitants, But what it does is through that imagery of ancient Jewish custom, it gives you an idea of the complexity there. It gives you an idea of what this battle is all about in the book of Revelation and what these judgments are all about and what the takeover in Revelation chapter 19 is all about. But we admit the truth of it to this date. Here's where we stand on the matter. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 7 through 8. 7 and 8. You have made him, that would be mankind, a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor and have set him over the work of your hands. You gave him the title deed to the earth. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put in all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him, but we do not yet see all things put under him. In other words, God gave mankind this dominion. He gave mankind rule over the earth, but as it stands, mankind does not have that dominion. And as of yet, a kinsman, a family member, hasn't stepped in to redeem the earth. So, before we move on, I want to ask you the question, who is presiding over this proceeding? Where does the scroll begin in Revelation chapter 5? In the right hand of God the Father. The right hand in the Bible is always the hand of power and authority. So what that's saying to us is that the scroll, therefore the future of the property that is in dispute, is at the sole discretion of the decision of God the Father. And listen to what the Father said in Psalm chapter 2, verse 7. As the Father was speaking to his Son, Christ, he said, "You are my Son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession." All right. Now that you have a good idea of what this scroll involves, let's see what happens with it. Verse 2. Then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals?" Pay very close attention to the words of this angel. He doesn't ask who is willing to take the scroll. If that was the question he asked, there'd be a long line trying to get to that scroll. Alexander the Great was willing. Genghis Khan was willing. Charlemagne was willing. Napoleon was willing. Hitler was willing. Joe Biden is probably willing. I know Donald Trump is. He'd do it. Sure, give me a shot. I'll try my hand at ruling the earth. So the question is not about who is willing to do it or who wants the responsibility or who wants to give it a shot. The question is who is worthy. It is an invitation only to the worthy. And as we're going to unpack this, you're going to see there is only one who could possibly be worthy to take that scroll, meet the conditions and requirements for redemption, and start popping off those seals to claim what is his. Verse 3. And no one in heaven. Keep in mind, this is Revelation chapter 5. After all of God's people throughout all of history are safely ensconced into heaven prior to the beginning of the tribulation period, the fullness of God's people in heaven. And it says that no one in heaven, which would include angels, Old Testament saints, New Testament saints, no one in heaven was worthy to do this. Not Abraham, not Joseph, Jacob, Moses, Joshua, David, certainly not Solomon. He had some skeletons in the closet. not the Apostle John, not the Apostle Peter, not the earthly mother of Jesus, Mary, not the Apostle Paul, not Paul Nutter, no one that is in heaven at this time will be found worthy to take this scroll and meet the requirements. So no one in heaven or on the earth. Now, who would still be on the earth at this time? Those alive that have missed the rapture because they have rejected Christ. So those existing in a state of unbelief prior to the rapture. So those that have rejected Christ, those that talk a big game in their blasphemies against Christ right now, not a single hand's going to go up. Don't let them fool you. They're going to be petrified. No one in heaven or on the earth. How about this one? Or under the earth. Now that is a reference to hell, to Hades. Interesting. The Lord's given everyone a fair shot here. No matter where you are at this point in history, the Lord gives you the opportunity, if you're worthy, to step up and take the scroll. And there's no one in hell that's worthy. We're not surprised. Voltaire, Nietzsche, Stephen Hawking, none of them. No one is worthy to take the scroll. And I like this part. No one was able to open the scroll or to look at it. So no one in heaven, earth, or under the earth could even bring themselves to look at the stipulations for redemption. It was just a pointless thing. Verse 4, so I wept much because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it. Now wait a minute, you might be saying. John is weeping in heaven? I didn't think there were tears in heaven. I thought that's what the Bible taught. There are no tears in heaven. No, you're mistaken. That's an Eric Clapton song. And while he may be a good guitarist, he's not a good theologian. I know many Christians believe this, but the Bible does not teach that there will be no tears in heaven. It doesn't teach that. John is weeping in heaven, Revelation chapter 5. As we read the next 14 chapters, you're going to see plenty of stuff to weep about, and you're going to see tears. It's not that there's not tears in heaven. It's just that the Lord has promised to bring us to a point in time, if you can say that about eternity. He's promised to bring us to a point in time where that all comes to an end. And it doesn't happen until Revelation chapter 21. Verses 1 through 4. Just to pick a few out for you here, I'll read verse 1 and 4. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, good riddance. And at that point, verse 4, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There should be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There should be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. It's at that point in time, during eternity, that you can say, from here on out, no tears in heaven. So John is weeping because this is it. This is the last call. This is the last chance for someone to redeem the earth away from the rule of Satan. If it doesn't happen here in Revelation chapter 5, it ain't happening at all. That's why John is weeping. The open window for redemption would expire soon, and Satan would retain the title deed to the earth permanently. Now, think back. There's an association of numbers here. A Jewish property owner who sold his property had how many years to get that property back? 7 years. Now, let's ask the question, how many millennia has it been since Adam and Eve traded away the title deed to the earth to Satan? Do the math. Approximately 4,000 years until the incarnation, the coming of Christ, 0 AD. And since the birth of Christ, approximately 0 AD, We have now passed 2,021 years of Earth history. That's a total of 6,021 years of history. So what I'm telling you is that if the numbers have a significance, if the Lord meant for those to connect, and I believe he did, then what I'm telling you is that we are in the last millennia for this redemption of the earth to take place. And it makes sense, doesn't it? If you sell a little piece of property on the earth, you get 7 years to buy it back to redeem it. But when the issue is over the entire earth, it just kind of makes sense that you do things in God's time, where a day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is as a day. He reckons time differently. It just makes sense that you'd stick with that same number, seven, but you'd add some zeros to it. That's what I believe is the significance of John's weeping. If no one could step forward now in Revelation chapter 5 and meet the conditions and requirements for redemption, then all would be lost. Verse 5. But one of the elders said to me, so this is one of the 24 elders. We said last week, the 24 elders represents all of God's people in heaven. So this is a human being that has been saved by Christ, glorified, and taken up into heaven. In other words, it could be you. It could be me. It could be someone we know. Most likely not. It's probably going to be Peter, James, and John that gets this honor. You know it. They get all of the special privileges, don't they? That's the core group. But it's a human being that's been redeemed. An elder says to John, "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose its seven seals." Now, we will likely go into more detail on this next week because I want to talk about those two Jewish phrases there. The Lion of the tribe of Judah and the Root of David. So we'll come back to that, I believe. At least that's my plan for right now. But for right now, let's dial into this truth that we're seeing in Revelation 5:5. That Jesus steps forward as the worthy one. We know that this is Christ. This is Jesus. He gave a nice long pause. Why did he do that? Was it for dramatic effect? Does he like drama? Does he like to build suspense? Was it to scare us? Because it worked with John. John wept like a crybaby. Is it like, you know, we parents do with our kids? We're so cruel. Halloween comes around, and there we are with a mask on, hiding in the closet, waiting for our kid to come in so that our kid comes in and we can scare the life out of them. Oh, we're gonna take the mask off. We're going to show them it's really us. But first, we want to see them panic and fear. What's wrong with people? Is that what the Lord is doing here? Dramatic effect? Scare us good? Of course not. He was giving everyone ample time to lay claim to this. He was letting everyone else, go first. Go ahead, take a shot at it. So there's that long pause in heaven, and it freaked John out. But it was to establish a truth that there is only one. There is only one that is worthy to take that scroll, meet those requirements, and then start breaking open those seals. Now, this tells us a lot about what is written on the backside of that scroll. Just think about this. How was that scroll lost? Sin. So we would probably guess, and I think rather safely, that one of the requirements that was written on the back of this scroll to redeem the earth would have to be this: perfect righteousness. That's requirement number one. Already you can understand why no one else can step up and lay hold to this scroll, not even bother to look at it. Requirement number one, perfect holiness, divine holiness, God's holiness. But remember something. The original owner, mankind. So if it's going to be redeemed, it's got to be redeemed by someone in the family. God just can't stay in heaven all the time. and then at the last minute swoop down and claim this. It wouldn't be just in the eyes of God. So for this to be a kinsman, a family member that steps in and redeems the planet for mankind, it has to be someone that is in the family. It has to be a man. Are you starting to connect the dots? Requirement number three. And I guess you could call this conjecture, but I just know it to be true. What is the price of the redemption of this piece of property? The rest of the Bible tells us. Without blood, there is no remission of sin. And that can't just happen through continual animal sacrifice. The book of Hebrews tells us that the blood of goats and bulls, the sacrificial blood of animals, never did eradicate sin. It never did completely wash sin away. All that it did was temporarily cover sin in order to appease the righteousness of God until God could work out a perfect redemption. So perfect redemption, according to the scriptures, has to come from perfect divine blood. So you need spotless, sinless perfection. You need to be a man, and you need to lay down your life for redemption. And there's only one person. There's only one being that fits the requirements that I'm sure were written on some form on the back of this scroll, and that is Jesus himself. He told us this is exactly why he came to earth. He told us that in that one verse long parable about the... It's in Matthew chapter 13, that one verse parable about the hidden treasure. This is verse 44. Tiny little parable that packs a punch. One verse. Jesus said, again, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid. And for joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Now, we understand what the symbolism is here. Jesus explained the metaphors that he used in these parables. He told us point blank, the field is the world. So you see the picture here. Jesus revealing to the disciples his plan to come to the earth, to see the field, the world, and find in the world a treasure. Now, the treasure in the world is you and I, those of us who have come to know him as Savior, those of us who have believed on him. Now, there's plenty in the field, there's plenty in the world that isn't exercising faith in him, coming to belief, coming to salvation. There's plenty in the field that is not treasure to him. He wants it to be, but it can't be. But for the treasure, for you and I, those of us that are saved, Jesus purchased the entire field. Again, the field is the world. How did he purchase the world? How did he purchase back the earth? He purchased it through his blood. So wait a minute. If Jesus met the requirements to take back the title deed to the earth and come into his kingdom in totality and fullness and completeness there in 33 AD, then why didn't he just do that? Why are we still waiting for all things to be put under his feet? Why are we not seeing that yet? Shouldn't he have just went ahead and claimed his kingdom on the spot? Well, the disciples thought that too, there in Acts chapter 1. As the Lord was getting ready to ascend back into heaven, and the disciples ask him, Lord, are you going to at this time restore the kingdom? Now, they were primarily concerned about Israel. They were tired of the Roman bondage. But the question they were asking is of broad scope. What they were saying is, Lord, we understand what you did. You paid the price to redeem back all of the earth. It's all yours by right. You paid for it with your own blood. You created it. You gave it to mankind. Mankind squandered it away to a new master. You purchased it back with your own blood. The kingdoms of the world are yours. Jesus, aren't you going to at this time restore the kingdom? Boy, that's a good question, Lord. Why didn't you do it? Just a few things to throw out to you before we close here. Had he done that, you wouldn't be saved because you would have never been born. That's better than being born and not being saved, but... And maybe you're okay with that. Lord, I'm okay with that. If I never came into existence and, you know, didn't get to spend eternity with you, hey, at least I'm not spending eternity in hell. Maybe that's okay with you, but that wasn't okay with the Lord. The Lord, for whatever reason, decided that he needed you in heaven, that he wanted you in heaven on that day, Revelation chapter 5. I can understand why he wanted me there. I can't understand why he wanted you there, but Jesus could only give that encouragement. Folks, you're right. The purchase price has been met. The requirements on the back of the scroll to the title deed to earth, it's been met. I could take it right now and claim it right now, but Jesus encouraged them with this. Don't get all focused on the time period. Don't get all focused on, is it going to happen? And when is it going to happen? And Jesus gave that promise to them that don't worry about the times and seasons. That's in the Father's control. That's on his time schedule. That's in his calendar. But you, the believer, until then, until the Lord steps up into the throne room, takes the scroll from the hand of God, and starts opening up its seals. Until that happens, Jesus said, you can be filled with power, endued with the power of the Holy Spirit. You can have kingdom power coursing through your veins. You can be a part of his kingdom right now. The rest of the earth may be following after the prince of the power of the air. They may be involved in this current kingdom of the world, but you can be a part of another kingdom. The kingdom rule of God can be in your hearts. So that day is coming when the Lord takes the scroll, redeems the earth, finally lays claim to what belongs to him in Revelation chapter 5. And then we get all those promises. The meek shall inherit the earth. The Lord really means that. The earth, for 1,000 years, is going to come back under our dominion. The scriptures tell us we shall rule and reign with him. Of course, he purchased it. We're in this together. He's a family member. We're going to rule and reign over all of the kingdoms of the earth together. Just look ahead at Revelation chapter 5, verse 10, that last phrase. This is the church worshiping in heaven. This is all of God's people worshiping in heaven. And what do they say? We shall reign on the earth. In other words, this is it. It finally happened. All of our prayers have been toward this end. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. How long have we been praying for the fulfillment of the kingdom of God? Every time you pray those prayers of, Lord, oh, let justice be done in that case. What happened was horrendous. What that person did was horrendous. Let your justice be done. How many times have we prayed, Lord, I'm so sick and tired of the perversion and wickedness that I see on the earth. I just wish you'd do away with all of that. See, all of those prayers are looking forward to this moment and its fulfillment. When our kinsman, from the place of his vast spiritual wealth, steps in through his gracious sacrifice and finally claims that scroll, and we will reign on the earth.